This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
I think that the first move forward has to really be a ceasefire. As the conflict is escalating, we're seeing the situation on the ground for people getting much worse. There's over 1,000 people now in Tripoli have been killed. The power, the water, the fuel situation is deteriorating by the day.
That's Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, talking about the prospects for peace in Libya. Details next. Also, the current Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo is affecting more children than normal. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. A delegation of more than 80 Libyan parliamentarians has concluded a meeting in Cairo, reaffirming the importance of maintaining their country's sovereignty through unity. They stressed that the conflict there should be solved through the Libyan House of Representatives as the only legitimate authority elected by the people. The lawmakers pledged to focus their efforts on unifying divisive factions and freeing the country from regional interference. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke with Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, about Parliament's potential role in reaching a negotiated settlement.
The problem with this particular meeting is that although the delegates talked about unity and sovereignty, those participating are mainly the HOR members who are backing the Libyan National Army, and they are therefore quite clearly on one side of the ongoing conflict in Libya. In addition, the fact that they stressed the legitimacy of the House of Representatives, although that can be argued that they were elected, their term has now expired, the question of who has political legitimacy in Libya is a very tricky question, and there are many Libyans who would disagree with that statement. Therefore, as a starting point for a truly unity, a kind of government or a peace accord, this doesn't seem like a particularly inclusive way to start because it will already alienate quite a large proportion of the Libyan population.
But they promised to talk to the other members of the parliament who are against General Haftar's effort to take over Tripoli.
That is true. So in the statement, they mentioned to include the other HOR members in other parts of the country. And while in theory, if they're able to do that, that could be a positive start. The reality is that quite a few of the HOR members who are not in the east or who are in other parts of the country have kind of started their own separate, they've had separate meetings away from the eastern part of the country. So it's difficult to see in reality how they would be able to hold these meetings. And because of the concerns over legitimacy, the divisions in the country, because the HOR in itself is already a kind of tainted institution, that is the concern with whether that would be a good starting point or not for a political initiative.
The Cairo meeting focused on freeing Libya from regional interference, especially from Turkey. What do you make of that when they are not talking about the interference from Egypt and the United Arab Emirates and other parties?
Exactly, and this is one of the kind of ironic things about the statement. So they're talking about avoiding foreign interference, which is a huge issue in Libya. So we are seeing, Turkey supplying arms, for example, to the GNA aligned forces. But on the other hand, you have Egypt, the UAE, and even reports that France this week have supplied US-made weapons to the LNA, for example. You know, foreign interference is a big problem, but you can't really tackle that or not tackle it in a fair way when one of the main kind of backers of one of the sides in a conflict, in this case Egypt, is the one hosting the talks. And I think for that reason, this is why it's quite difficult to see how this new political initiative is anything other than the Egypt and UAE realizing that the LNA's assault in Tripoli isn't going to be the quick military victory that they had hoped for, that they are therefore trying to establish another political track that will still result in the kind of eastern factions being on top in the Libya conflict. And I think it does have to be seen in the kind of very, unfortunately, divisive political light that Libya is currently embroiled in.
So what are the way out of the complicated Libyan crisis right now?
I think that the first move forward has to really be a ceasefire. As the conflict is escalating, we're seeing the situation on the ground for people getting much worse. There's over 1,000 people now in Tripoli have been killed. The power, the water, the fuel situation is deteriorating by the day. And as the violence and killing continues, the divisions and the mistrust among Libyans is only going to get worse. So although a political and a peace process does need to happen, for a start, it needs to be one that isn't pushed by one particular side or another. So, and it's very difficult to do, admittedly, but it needs to be, I think, a new process that can really have a chance of bringing lots of different actors together rather than just one side or the other. And that really needs, that can only really start when the fighting has stopped. Otherwise, there will continue to be these drivers for division and conflict.
That was Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy. The current Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo is affecting more children than normal. The United Nations Children's Fund says kids represent nearly one-third of current total cases, compared with about 20% in previous outbreaks. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The World Health Organization reports more than 2,500 cases of Ebola in eastern Congo, including nearly 1,670 deaths. The UN Children's Fund says about 750 of those cases are children. UNICEF spokeswoman Marixi Mercado says children under age 5 are especially hard hit and account for 40% of infections. She notes an exceptionally high number of children are succumbing to the virus.
The case fatality ratio, or the number of cases who die among this group of under 5s, is 77%. That's compared with 67% among the general population, which means that young children are at higher risk than adults.
Mercado says Ebola affects children very differently from adults. Consequently, she says they need specialized care both medically and psychologically. She says children infected with Ebola receive the same drugs as adults, but they require smaller dosages. She says they also require treatment for diarrhea, against intestinal parasites, and special nutritional feeding. She says children who are separated from their parents or orphaned from Ebola need longer-term psychosocial care and support to help them get over their loss.
Virtually all of them need help to counter the debilitating effects of stigma and discrimination that taints children affected by Ebola. They need to be accepted, valued, and loved by their families and communities.
In Congo, Mercado says dedicated pediatricians provide special medical care for children in Ebola treatment centers. She says every child is assigned a dependable caregiver who also is an Ebola survivor and therefore immune to the disease. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Nearly a year after a major Ebola outbreak began in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the death count continues to grow despite widespread screening and the use of an effective vaccine that didn't exist during the worst outbreak of the virus in West Africa in 2014. New drugs also have trimmed what had been a 90% fatality rate. So far, Ebola has mostly afflicted those in rural areas. However, on Sunday, a case was discovered in Goma, a city of more than 2 million people, prompting fears that the highly contagious virus could spread rapidly. To find out more about Ebola in the DRC and what can be done to contain it, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Dr. Emmanuel Capobianco, Global Director of Health and Care for the International Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. Capobianco had just returned to Nairobi from the DRC.
It is a major emergency that has affected more than 2,600 people with approximately 1,400 deaths. And it keeps moving. We had cases in Uganda a few weeks ago, and yesterday actually we heard the report of a case in Goma, a city with 1 million population.
Tell me about Goma and why that's a particular danger that may be different than a single case might be in one of these more remote regions that we associate Ebola with.
The proximity of people. The proximity is just an extreme propeller for transmission. Now, in Goma at the moment, we have one case detected, and this was detected early. The contacts were traced, immunization has been started, and so somehow the system has been responding properly and timely. That, coupled with the fact that this case was detected early, gives us some hope that this localized outbreak in Goma may be contained. But we'll know the response only in a few weeks' time.
Of course, one huge difference between this outbreak and the one in 2014 is that the DRC is an active conflict zone.
That's correct. This outbreak has happened in one of the most difficult zones that I've seen. 2 decades of conflict characterized by migrant population, deprivation in terms of health, a cholera outbreak, a measles outbreak. Add to this the fact that the outbreak came up at the time of elections in a zone that that's not fully controlled by government. And you can imagine the explosive situation. There was a lot of organized insecurity and attacks against workers, and every attack brings the response back 1 or 2 or 3 or 10 steps. And there has been also cases of resistance generally of the population who thought that Ebola was a disease that had been created to suspend election, and actually the elections were not conducted in those regions. And people who thought that this Ebola was brought by foreigners. And so all this fueled a lot of resistance.
I know that those who turned down the vaccine are in the minority, but how do you deal with that? How do you deal with the resistance that remains?
We need to help people realize that vaccine is protecting and saving life. The solution to that is the communities leading the response, having the survivors of the outbreak being part of the teams that provide the response to the outbreak. And through that, gaining that community ownership that is critical to fight back. Of course, there was fear moving around, and that's why, in my opinion, the survivors will be one of the critical strategies to convince people that Ebola is not a death sentence, that you can be cured from Ebola.
What other strategies can you use to stem this outbreak, to get people's trust?
You don't come in with armed guards or the military. That is not going to win the trust of the community. You need to get the trust for this community by listening to them, listening to their needs, having people like our volunteers who come from those communities who understand the language, who understand the underlying factors.
So what have your volunteers and others been hearing from people on the ground?
What we have been hearing constantly is that the main priority is not Ebola. They are worried about lack of access to water. They are worried about malaria. They are worried about education and other elements. We need to move beyond the biomedical intervention and really look at the social science on how you get people on board. It's a long journey. It's a journey that goes community after community, family after family.
That was Emmanuel Capobianco, the Global Director of Healthcare for the International Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies in Nairobi, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Officials say Zimbabwe's trade deficit narrowed by 71% to $325 million between February and May, with analysis attributing the change to a shortage in foreign currency. Adigando gives us more on the issue.
Zimstat, which is responsible for national data, says that between February and May, the country imported goods and services worth $1.59 billion against exports of $1.27 billion. Over the same period last year, imports were pegged at $2.34 billion and exports were pegged at $1.23 billion, causing a trade deficit of $1.1 billion. Economic analysts attribute the narrowing trade deficit to dwindling foreign currency in the country. Dumisani Sibanda gives his view.
What has basically happened is that imports have come down. because we don't have foreign currency to pay. So it's the availability constraint that has suppressed the imports.
Banda says deficits are a function of availability of foreign currency.
When you look at power alone, power in 2018, power imports were about, on average, about 14 million a month, and there's not much being imported now because we don't have foreign currency, but also because of the debts, you know, the arrears with Eskom and the power company in Mozambique.
Zimstat reports that exports marginally improved by 3.3% on the prior year figures, while imports fell by 32%. The country's main trading partners are South Africa, China, Congo, and Botswana. Zimbabwe is a signatory to the recently formed Africa Free Trade Area. Observers say this is an opportunity for the country to expand the export market for its goods and services. But structural challenges in the economy, such as inconsistent energy generation, potentially hamper competitiveness in the new Pan-African market with a population of 1.3 billion people.
So the cost to industry is very high because the opportunity cost of reducing capacity utilization because of shortage of power, it increases the cost structures of this business and the risks to employment and so on. So the lack of sufficient energy, it will be a big cost in the long run. The economy will suffer and aggregate demand will go down. Exports, yeah, they become difficult.
According to Trading Economics website, exports in Zimbabwe rose to $348 million in February, up from $292 million in January. Flue-cured tobacco accounted for 23% of total exports, followed by nickel at 20%, then gold, platinum and chrome. Zimstat says imports are led by consumer goods such as wheat, vehicles and medicines, which account for a large component of imports. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo.
21 past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Aid workers in Uganda say armed conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo has doubled the flow of refugees since June, straining humanitarian funding. Many DRC refugees brave the cold nights and risk the big waves on Lake Albert to reach the Ugandan border. Halima Tumani reports from Sibagoro landing site in southwestern Uganda.
In the pitch black hours of the early morning, a boatload of refugees from the Democratic Republic of Congo arrives on the Ugandan side of Lake Albert. Some of the babies are hysterical. Aid workers say the number of Congolese refugees fleeing armed conflict to Uganda has more than doubled since June to about 300 per day. Refugee Gipato Margaret says there has been intensive fighting in the last 2 weeks in the DRC town of Chomia. There are so many soldiers, yet the enemy rebel groups are in the surrounding forests. If they find a person in the garden, they kill you. They completely finish you. And when they see government soldiers, they follow and kill and fight them. We saw it was too much. There's a lot of gunshots nearby and staying there got difficult, so we had to find a way out. Refugee Joshua Oshaki lost contact with his wife during fighting in the DRC's Ituri region, but managed to escape with his two children. We got here in the night. We moved with children and other people. We moved in the cold. The children are suffering. We are hungry till now. And so many things got lost, clothes, money and property. We do not have peace in Congo. Fighting over land, mineral wealth and politics has raged in eastern Congo for more than two decades. Uganda works with the UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, to register and transport new arrivals to camps already hosting over a million refugees, 350,000 of them from the DRC. The UNHCR's deputy representative to Uganda, Kenlin Fali, says the influx of refugees has stretched the agency's funding.
It's about 17% of all the needs that need to be covered. So this new influx is definitely challenging. You know, we're short of funds for the assistance that they need immediately, life-saving assistance upon arrival.
The World Food Programme says it is managing to provide aid for the new refugees, but warns its budget won't last long. Julie MacDonald is the Deputy Country Director for WFP Uganda.
At this point in time, we are scheduled to run out of food and cash by September. And so we do urgently need new contributions in order to ensure that we can continue to feed the refugees.
Meanwhile, there seems no end to the flow of Congolese refugees fleeing for safety to Uganda. Halima Athmani for VA News on the shore of Lake Albert, Uganda.
For decades, the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, the Ituri and North Kivu provinces especially, has endured ethnic violence, leaving thousands dead and many more seeking refuge in neighboring countries. Halima Tumani spoke with survivors of the violence at the refugee settlement in western Uganda and with analysts about why the conflict drags on.
54-year-old Mwamoyo Chantal has lived in a Ugandan refugee settlement for 6 years now after fleeing violence in Congo's North Kivu province. When she arrived, Chantal found long-lost family members who had fled the same region during what's known as the First Congo War in 1996 and 1997. Chantal explains why she thinks fighting has persisted since the end of the 32-year rule of the late Mobutu Sese Seko. He held the country like he owned it all alone. During the fighting, it seems they discovered that Congo has minerals, so everyone is now fighting for the wealth in Congo. DRC refugees continue to arrive at the Ugandan border by the boatload across Lake Albert. Refugee Joshua Oshaki says he lost contact with his wife during fighting in the DRC's Ituri region, but managed to escape with his two children. In the beginning, the conflict was tribal. Different tribes would fight each other. The Hema and the Lendu would be joined by the Wangiti and other tribes. They would kill each other. Currently, the fighting has faces of government soldiers and civilians. Even as the DRC's people struggle to survive, the country is considered one of the richest in the world in mineral wealth. Critics say few benefits are harnessed by the state for ordinary people, while mining companies and the elite become rich. Dismas Nkunda is the executive director of the watchdog group Atrocities Watch Africa.
Who supports the strong militiamen, the individuals who hold sway in the vast lands of controlling properties and areas? Who does that? So certainly foreign powers are involved. Certainly countries neighboring DRC are involved, all of them. They have interests in a DRC that is not as stable as it should be.
Last week, Presidents Paul Kagame of Rwanda, Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, Yao Lourenco of Angola, and Congo's President Felix Tshisekedi held a meeting in Luanda to discuss, among other things, the security situation in the Great Lakes region. The three countries, plus Burundi and Eritrea, escalated the 1996 conflict in Congo, then known as Zaire, either by sending state forces or backing militia groups to defeat various rebel groups based in Congo. It's not clear yet whether the presidential summit will yield any effort to end the suffering of Congolese people who have to flee their homes. Halima Athmani for VA News, Changwali, Uganda.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, after months of violent protests in Sudan, a preliminary power-sharing agreement has been negotiated between the Forces for Democratic Change and the Transitional Military Council. Sudan in transition on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.